So only three people voted for the slot for the exam. I remind you, I think you guys voted, right? You didn't. So please do it. And those who listen to us offline, please vote. Okay, so this is the last lecture. I didn't know how much I managed to tell you. Basically, the point here that started from the previous time already is to show yet another collection of examples where you can get bonads. So we started with the denotational semantics, and we have seen that denotational semantics as something that provides examples of monads, and that's the place where they arise naturally. And another realm is algebraic data types. So these are the monads which you typically use in Haskell, because you first declare an algebraic data type and then it turns out to be a monad. And so what you've started last time are monads. So I can just say algebra. So these are monads that arise from algebra in the sense, in the mathematical sense. These are traditionally the mathematical side of using monads and dealing with them. And these are more like computer science, but presently we can understand computationally relevant monads in terms, in algebraic terms, and I will try to show that. And as you see, these areas overlap, because you can transfer from that side to that side, and there is something in common, and there is something where there is some difference, but these are like three views. It's nice to have some understanding of monads in terms of any of these approaches. So I have already defined the concept of algebraic monads last time, and postulated the theorem that if you start with an algebraic theory and you consider terms, modulo equivalence relation algebraic identified by the theories, then these terms over variables x from some set x can be identified with the object T of x. And that T, which is derived from there, can be shown to be a monad. So I have to finish that construction, because I claimed that that was a correct definition, but we need to verify this. And I also mentioned that, so correctness of the definition of TE. I'm not sure if I introduced this notation. Yes? So that's the monad which arises from E. And what we have to show is that our definition of the classy star, it doesn't depend on representative of the equivalence class. So we have to show so if we take some other t, then what sigma star of t is equal to sigma star of t prime, right? Indeed. So by definition, this thing is equal to and this thing is equal to this. Also, so of course, this t and t prime, they can have different sets of free variables, but we can, without loss of generality, assume that these variables which you mentioned here, they include both variables from t and t prime, because, I mean, if some of the variables do not occur in t, then the substitution just would not change the term. So we always can extend the set of free variables that we involve. Okay, and therefore, so, right, there are no primes here. So we have got, by these equations, we have the fact that every Si is equivalent to Si prime. Right, and we also know that t is equivalent to t prime. So we just can start with this term and replace equivalent things by each other. So I replace t by t prime and every s by s prime by a dilemma that I've proved in the previous lecture. And therefore, these terms are equal. And so since these terms are equivalent, their equivalence classes are the same. And therefore, indeed, okay. So they improved the clocks. So they showed the wrong type previously, and now it's perfect. There's this saying by Lewis Carroll that the clocks which do not run, they show the correct time more often than the one they which were 1 minute late. So, okay. So what we can do next is we can prove one part of the theorem. That T is a monad on set, and we do it in two steps. So okay, so it's easier to show this if we split the claim in two parts. So we consider a simpler case when this algebraic theory doesn't have equations. So it's not something silly, it's still an interesting case because we still have operations, just these operations don't satisfy any equations. And in this case, the proof is simpler. Okay. We need to, as usual, to check this. And this is an exercise. So I only verify the third Moore law, F star G star is equal to F star G star. So how can we do it? So what is this? It's some. These are two maps from t theta x to t theta y. So, and right, how do they work? Basically, this is true if and only if f star g star applied to any t is equal to f star g star to any other t, where t is in t theta x. So, and how we verify it? So let's unfold it by definition. F star, and here so T, and which we substitute G of x1, and so on, G of xn. Right, so we don't need to mention the equivalence classes anymore because there are no equations, so every equivalence class is just the term itself. So we therefore just forget about this equivalence class brackets. So, and this is equal to T of G of x1. X1 Okay. So I just unfolded the definition of the star 2 times. and get this. And now this is just a standard substitution. So, and yeah, this is something I consider to be obvious, that we know that substitution into a term means that we can substitute it here, and then we can substitute it here. So this is equal to this, f So here it's n, of course, or not even n, this is m. I think this is, I did a mistake here. And now I can wrap it in again. So I get so basically, I can transform this thing, I guess. So this is just f star applied to t. And here, this is f star applied to g of x1. F star g of xn. Xn. So, and this is equal to f star g star of t. No, wait, something is wrong. So I think this substitution here doesn't doesn't work out because, yeah, because y's are the term, the variables on which depends on which g's depends, but t doesn't depend on them, right? So the y's are the variables of g's. Of course, this is all modulo the assumption that so that x and y must be disjoint, of course. So I just do not have this substitution here at all. So this one I don't have. And here, then I have t. And then it works. So that's yet another example of that associativity principle, which is part of the monad axiomatization. We've got this loss, unit one, unit two, and the associativity. And you've seen that this associativity pops up in various contexts, like in programming contexts. And here it means essentially that substitution is associative. So we've done this calculation and we see why this equation holds. That's because substitution has this property that if you substitute one term to another and then substitute again, then you can rearrange the order in which you substitute, and that's an equivalent transformation. Okay, so that was the first part, and the second part suppose E has equations then let us write let's say sigma 1 or sigma equivalent to theta with sigma and theta going from x T E Y if sigma of X is equivalent to sigma of X or from theta of X for any X in X. So I will explain why we need it. So we've got the this equivalence relation for terms saying that two terms are equivalent if the equation is provable in the theory. But for convenience, we also need to extend this equivalence to functions like this. So these functions are like parameterized terms, and I say that these two terms are equivalent if they're equivalent on every value of the parameter. And then we show that the following property, what was it? Let's write it F, no, sigma. So that's like an auxiliary property that we need to finish the proof. Right? So this is an equivalence class of. Is it correct? That's probably not, doesn't quite type because sigma goes from x to t theta x, and then the equivalence class contains, is a class of functions, and it's not a map from x to t theta x. So let's modify it a bit. That this is equal to this, where sigma is equivalent to let's write it like this: sigma x is equal to f of x for every x So here, what we have sigma going from x to t theta x, theta y, and f goes from x to sigma e theta y. So here, basically, I'm assuming that for the sigma, which for every x returns an equivalence class, I have some representative f, which for every x returns a term, not modular equivalences. But this says that basically sigma is obtained by f by applying the equations. So this also means that no, probably cannot write it down, doesn't matter. Okay, so how can we check it? Again, by definition. Sigma star of t is equal to what was this? And since we have this equation for every x, so therefore also f of xi is equal to is equivalent to Si, or putting it differently, f of xi, so this equivalence class is equal to this equivalence class. Well, actually, that's probably not needed. So, therefore, we can continue it. Sigma star t tilde is equal to t f x1 xn n I forgot the star here, sorry. And this is indeed equal to f star of t. So the point of this property is that we relate this Kleist star for the theory with equation, with the Kleist star for the same theory, but if we forget about the equations. Because, so F is this map for just for the theory containing only symbols of that theory. And when I write the Kleist star here, it means that the Kleist star with respect to this theory and not with respect to this theory. So, and the benefit of this is here, I can calculate this expression without involving the equivalence classes. And so this property relates this to two liftings. So one is for the one with equations. So basically, if we apply sigma to an equivalence class, it's the same as applying the map representing sigma to an element of that equivalence class and then applying the equations. So that's the point. And this is kind of a lemma inside this theorem, which we still keep proving. But then if you have this lemma, then the rest is easy, because the second part of the theorem, which we are proving now when we do have equations, is reduces to the first part where we don't have equations, precisely because of this property. So again, the same thing. This is again exercise. And we verify this one. Or maybe I write it like this. Sigma star theta is equal to sigma star theta star. So note that there are F and G such hypo that sigma X is equivalent to this is not the way how I'm supposed to write it. So basically I have to write it like this. So because otherwise it just wouldn't type, because the result of sigma is an equivalence class, and I have to have an equivalence class on the right hand side too. So and here sigma x is equal to f of x. Right, so this is something trivial, because sigma and theta, they are functions which return equivalence class. Every equivalence class has a representative, so I can form this f of x as the function which chooses that representative. So therefore, I can pick out such n, f, and g. And then I think I'm almost done, because in order to show this equation, I just apply this to an arbitrary T, to an arbitrary equivalence class like this. And then I can, I can do what? Yes, I can hopefully use my property star. Well, first I reformulate it like this. And then by this property star, I have sigma star of f of t. And this is, no, it's not f, it's g here. And then this is f of g of t. And I forget the stars. Okay, this is again star. And here I so here I'm using the part one of my theorem, because now I have this expression where the star is for the theory without equations. So I can apply the Monod laws, the Monod law from the previous, from part one of the theorem. So I have, I can regroup it and get this. And then I do everything in the reverse order. So I've got well, maybe it's not so easy to do it in the reverse order. So let me introduce some psi, possibly. So this is again by star, where where xi is such that what xi of x is equal to so because if I want to apply the star, I need to have such an element, such an f that no also star yes so to match with this property star, I need some xi with this property. Okay, and what is this xi? Psi would take this composition. What was it? Okay, so if we take, if we really check that ask psi, we can take this composition. So then this would be precisely what we need to finish the proof, because we precisely would have the law. So would have the property that this, the action of this on this term is equal to the action of this on the same term, hence they are equal as functions. So we only need to check if we really can take as psi the thing. So we have to check if this holds. That sigma star of theta of x equal to f star g of x. Okay, do we see that it's true? Okay, so that has to be unfolded, indeed, sigma star of theta of x is equal to, so again by star, this is equal to, no, it's not by it's not by star. So this is equal to sigma star of g of x, right? So theta of x, okay, of here's y, it's equal to that. And now I can apply the star. And this is then equal to f of g of x star. Yeah. So indeed. Right, so this is sort of technical, but basically conceptually this theorem falls into two parts, and one part about the theory without equations, and the verification is easy, and the second part says if you add the equations that doesn't change much, because the sequence in which the order in which you start quotient in the terms modulo equation doesn't matter again, because this quotient in modular equation, it distributes over substitution, so you can pretend that your terms are not quotient, then you verify all the laws and then you quotient the results. And yeah, basically I want to give you some examples, but we are moving quite slowly, I'm afraid. So maybe I... So basically I want to show you how this theory of algebraic monads, how it relates to those monads which we have considered before. But then we need to tell how we state that two monads are equivalent. Basically, to give this one example, even the simplest one, I need to say that this example produces something that we had before. And in which sense? Well, I need to say when two monads are equivalent. And well, using the toolkit of the category theory, that's quite easy to do, because what we need is basically to introduce so-called monad morphisms. So a natural transformation from S to A is a monad morphism if alpha of eta is equal to eta, and then alpha of F star is equal to alpha F star. Right, so if I ask you to give me a definition of a monad morphism, that would probably be something that you would offer. Because monads are functors, so and natural, morphisms of functors, we know they are natural transformations. So it's natural to assume that a monad morphism must be a natural transformation, but it also has to interact with the monad structure somehow. So how it interacts? Well, that's how it interacts. If we have a computation and we apply the monad morphism, that is the same as to have the, if we apply the monad morphism to a unit, it's like should produce the unit of the other monad, and it should also distribute through the crisis star. Moreover, if S and T are strong, a monad morphism alpha is strong if additionally We need to say how it interacts with the string. So it interacts in the following way. T of id times alpha. As a diagram. So we can draw it as a diagram. So we've got A, T, B, and tau T A times B. And here alpha, well, it's a natural transformation. So if we want to be completely precise, we add the index. So it's from S to T. So S. T right, so is a diagram. So we don't really need to care about the strings. The rest of our discussion is in the sets, and in sets every monad is strong. And in fact, you can verify that that this equation is always true. So strong monads over sets are just any monads, and strong morphisms are just morphisms. Okay, and so of course, when we define morphisms, it means that what we have in mind is defining a category. And the category here is the category of monads. Okay. This is two statements in one. Strong So these are two statements in one. You can forget about the strongs in brackets, and this is one statement. If you add strong everywhere, that's another statement. So, and this is trivial to verify. And now, basically, after we've done that, we know what an isomorphism of monad is, because we have a generic notion of isomorphisms in any category. This is a pair of mutually inverse morphisms. And now we've got the category of monads, or category of strong monads. And that definition, of course, applies here. So an isomorphism of monads is a pair of monad morphisms going in opposite directions, which are mutually inverse to each other. So, and now having got this, I can give you the simplest example of a of an algebraic monad, which is equivalent to something that we know already. Right, so recall that this this notation means the algebraic monad over the algebraic theory, over the signature, but with no equations. So, and the signature is, as you see, just contains lots of constants. So these are zero area operations, and they are indexed over some given set. So, can someone finish the sentence? What it's what should be what it should be equivalent to? No idea. Yes. So this is equivalent to the exception monad. So why it's like this? Basically, the algebraic monads in these terms are transformations which send every x to terms over x. And what sort of terms you can form with a signature like this? Not many, right? So a term would be a variable, and a term would be a constant. And there is nothing else because you cannot, you do not have operations of arity more than zero, and so they do not grow the terms, and therefore t of x, well, t theta of x would be the disjoint union of x and the set of all constants, in which are in the bijective correspondent with this e. So this t of x, t theta of x, would be isomorphic to x plus e. And this isomorphism extends to an isomorphism of monads. And one can basically take take this definition, which we had before about monad morphisms, and just take this isomorphism over sets and show that this isomorphism is actually compatible with the monad structure, because we know that what the monad structure here is, that's described in the previously in this lecture and the previous one. And we know what the monad structure for the exception monad is, that we have considered also. And it turns out that these two structures are completely in agreement with each other. And what it also says is that you can view this object of variables and exception as a kind of term in the very degenerate case, where I've got only constants and variables. And Kleist decomposition, Kleist lifting works as substitution for this sort of terms. Okay, so this was a very simple example. And it's really easy to verify that it's true. And it's not as easy if you start including equations. So example, let theta be the following theory. Let's say we have plus, which is a binary operation, and this operation, which I don't give a name yet, and it's a constant. And let be e be generated by axioms over theta. So the following axioms. So consider this. Then this. No. Than this, and then x plus y plus z equal to x plus y plus z. Is it a familiar theory? Have you seen that somewhere? Paul, you've been to the semilattice, some semilattice lectures. More lattice theory.
No, the second axiom is
this one.
Somewhat strange.
Really? This one?
Yes.
What is strange about it? That's something that holds in semilattices, for example, because if you view plus as a meet or a join, well, let's say this is a meet and this is the bottom element, then this is the theory of pointed semilattices. So if you take the it must be join and the bottom. So if you join an element with the bottom element, it's that element. And this is idempotence, because if you join x and x, so what is the maximum of x and x? This is x. And this is commutativity and associativity. So this is a theory of pointed semilattices. Any guesses what it's equivalent to? So this is an entirely algebraic presentation of a monad. We give a theory and equations, and this produces us a monad. We know that. But do we have another description of this monad? Is it something that we know? So basically, the terms, if you look at the terms with respect to this theory, they look like this. I mean, they look like this anyway. So terms are trees, and you've got operations in the branches, and you've got variables in the nodes. That maybe x once again. So this would be a term for x plus y plus z plus y. But we've got equations. So terms are considered to be a modulo equivalent. So for example, this would be equivalent to this. X, y, z. Because if you apply the equation, then you can transform this term to that term. So a tree is not really a canonical choice. So there are trees which are equivalent. And when we consider Kleisli maps, they are maps which send variables to tree over some other variables. And when you compose two morphisms, it means that you do substitution. So you use one of the morphisms. If you calculate this thing, what you do is you take a term modulo equations and you apply the substitution sigma, which replaces variables in this T. So this is the general intuition. But what about this concrete theory? So basically, the domain every domain T E X is the set of terms modulo these equations, and we know that these equations the set of terms modulo these equations, and therefore we may try to see for some canonical form of the element in T E X. Basically, we can possibly represent every element of every element of TEX can be represented like this. Right? Because you just apply equations and you rearrange it. So essentially, every element of TEX can be viewed as a list of some variables. But that's also not a canonical representative, because we've got the commutativity axiom saying that these are lists modulo permutation of the elements. Right? Because if I come up with another tree where I swap X and Y, it's going to be equivalent to this one. So they are essentially list modulo permutations, and modulo, modulo permutations and modulo removing the duplicates. Because again, if you've got one variable occurring several times, you can remove that. So and what is it then? A list modulo permutation and modulo non-repetitive lists modulo permutations.
Well, that would just be sets.
That would be a finite set, yes. And that's why in this example T of X is isomorphic to TE P omega I find it. Finite power set. I'm not sure if I introduced this notation, but power set and finite power set, they are monads. And now you can further play with this example, because you can say, okay, let's forget about this some properties. So suppose we do not have permutation, example, so if and E, theta is S above, and E is generated by, so by a subset of these axioms like this, X plus, well, it's not really a subset. I've had an axiom which was derivable, but it's not derivable anymore. So this is a theory of monoids. So I remove the idempotence, I remove commutativity, and then TE is isomorphic to the least monad. If I add and so on. Well, there are not so much more to be said about this signature. Basically, that's an interesting example. If you find something between lists and sets, there is something in the middle. These are called multisets or bags. I don't know if you had it somewhere, but this is where you've got permutation, but you don't have idempotence. So you count the number of elements. So here you don't count the number of elements. You say an element either there or not, and you don't care about the number. So here you do not care about the sequence, but you care about the number of entries. So, and that turns out to be yet another monad. We didn't consider it, but it's a monad too. And finally, just very final example in this course, and it's interesting one because it shows that this theory is very, it produces lots of different things of different nature. So there is a really big class of monads which you can treat like this. So basically, by finding an appropriate algebraic representation for them, even for the state monad, you can do it. And this is something that I just show you. Okay, so this doesn't really matter, but so we've got a state monad with S equal to 2, so where 2 is 1 plus 1. And this has a special name. It's called rectangular band monad. And I could consider S being arbitrary, but it's just for the sake of presentation, it's simpler to show to write down the equations for the theory. So there are equations like this. We are 0 of x question mark. We are 1 x is equal to x. Okay, so this is my signature. There are two unary operations, and there's one binary operation. And intuitively, these are operations for writing, and this is an operation for reading. So we've got just two cells. Well, our S is 2, so we've got two memory locations, so we can only write 1 or write 2. Write 1 or write 0. So it's like 1-bit memory. And this operation is for reading. It checks if the written bit is 0 or 1, and depending on that, it takes the decision. And then in this slide, you can probably understand these equations, because what is seen here is, so you should read it as a program. And this program, basically every term like this can be written as a tree. And 0, right, 1, x, x. So this is the left-hand side of my equation written as a tree, and its tree is like a program flow. So I'm asking which bit I have. So if it's 0, then I return x. If it's 1, I return x. So in both cases, I return x. That's why this program is equivalent to x. And this is similar. So if I'm writing 0 and then I'm asking what is written, then I return the branch which corresponds to the left-hand side. And of course, the bit remains to be written, so that's why the write is here still mentioned. The same here symmetrically, and this is overriding. So if I wrote 1 and I wrote 0, then what is left is 0. So it's a radically different type of example. But it shows how powerful this theory of algebraic monad is, because you can unify so different things like power set and state monads. And these are, from this perspective, just various sorts of algebraic theories. So, and this theory axiomatizes the work with the store. Okay, that was the last example, and the end of the course. Thank you. We see each other tomorrow and maybe do some examples. And so,
Paul, you're coming to the end.